Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro, and this week my guest is science fiction writer Stephen Brust. Stephen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for being on the show. You're my first science fiction writer at all, ever, and I'm really excited to have you on the show. This is going to be a lot of fun. For the listeners, you are a science fiction writer with 31 novels to your credit.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
31. Yeah, that sounds right. That sounds right.
Yep. Somewhere in there. Known for the Vlad Taltos series and the Caveron romances. You're also a musician, drummer, guitarist, banjo player, and you have a solo record out. It's called The Rose for Iconoclastes. Fans of the science fiction writer Roger Zelazny will understand. So,
And no one else will.
I grew up reading Zelazny, Asimov, Clark, and Heinlein, and Zelazny was one of my wife's favorite authors and mine, too, and I loved everything he ever wrote. So we have that in common. But before that, I saw in the notes at Amazon that you were a computer programmer. You've been around long enough to have had almost a complete career as a programmer. Who did you work for and what did you do?
I worked for a few different companies. I was a PDP-11 specialist.
I remember those well. Yeah,
particularly working in Macro 11 on RT-11 device drivers and so on.
Did you have Space War installed on the PDP-11?
No. But if I'd known about it, I would have.
Those are the first space game.
Right. Okay. There was, there were a number of jobs, but the best one, you know, those high school rings they make, you know, like you had a class ring. It's a company called Jostens did that. And I was at the site where they did the ring molds, where they made the molds. It was a CAD/CAM thing. And, a guy would digitize a two-dimensional image on a tablet, and the 11 was in between that and the huge, amazing, it was the coolest, it was an Adage graphics machine is what it was called.
Adage, that rings a bell. Sounds familiar.
And I want one of those, just because, I mean, the thing had foot pedals and switches and knobs and dials. I watched the guy working on it and going, the games I could play on that thing. It's like, wow. And anyway, so yeah, I was in between getting it, translating it from the tablet into a form the graphics machine could use, and he would go and take it and put a three-dimensional and generate instructions for the machine that would drill out the molds.
How did you get that job? Was it by virtue of your education?
I'm trying to remember. I think a headhunter found it for me. I was previously working for a consulting firm. And I'm pretty sure that it was just, you know, some headhunter called me up, cold called me. I went over and talked to him, and it was just made for me. It was like a four-person shop, five of us, I guess. And it was just so much fun because tiny, little, intimate. And then you're old enough to remember the gold crunch when all of a sudden gold crashed.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the job ended. They had instructions from the company to lay someone off, and well, there was the boss, and then there was the guy who kept everything working, and then there was the secretary, and then there was the guy who made the things, and then there was me, and all of my programs were working. But they were a programmer's dream to work for. Let me just tell you that. When I walked in, they explained what they needed and what had to get done and blah, blah, blah. And I looked it over and I said, okay, listen, I can get this for you in 3 months. But if you let me take 6 months, we're going to end up with a whole bunch of tools that will just be really useful and that will fit in and be useful for everything. The guy said, yeah, sure, fine.
Oh, wow. That was an unexpected response.
Exactly. And it worked. I had just been, seriously studying Dijkstra and, structured design. And so I was really careful putting everything together, very modular, And by the end of it, after I got the thing working, he'd come up to me and he'd say, hey, can you whip me up something that does this? And I'd say, give me a week. And I'd look at what I had and realize that every single part already existed and I'd have it by that afternoon. And I looked like a genius.
Wow. It sounds like you really enjoyed that job. What brought it to an end?
I did. The gold crunch.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Orders to lay someone off. And like I said, everything I'd done was working.
Did you get into the Robert Heinlein mode where you thought, well, I better start doing some writing to put some groceries on the table?
No, but that was not exactly that. In fact, sort of the opposite of that. But that was exactly when I started writing. That would have been 1980.
Uh-huh.
I was married and got laid off and was collecting unemployment. My wife said, you've always wanted to write. We'll live on unemployment for 6 months, write a book, and then get another job. And that's exactly what we did. And I took 6 months, wrote my first novel.
That's a perilous exercise because there's a lot of time and pressure and commitment, and you don't know at this point in your life whether you have what it takes, whether you're creative enough, whether your ideas are going to sell. And then you pour your heart and soul into this first book, and if it isn't what the publisher wants, then you've kind of wasted 6 months, and there's still no paycheck coming in. So that's a big risk.
Here's the thing. I have said that the thing that defined my career from day one was luck. And that is a classic example because, no, there was no pressure. We were living on unemployment. And I was fine if the book hadn't sold. I never imagined that it would sell. I was writing it because, I wanted to write it. And when it sold, which took like a couple of years, I was absolutely blown away. And I still didn't seriously consider making a career of it for another 2 to 3 years.
Now, what I want to backtrack here a little bit. Normally, somebody who's inspired to write science fiction is somebody who grew up on science fiction. Was that the case with you, and what authors inspired you?
Absolutely. If you want to know why my goal, what got me into writing, it's purely and simply, I wanted to make other people feel the way I felt when I read Lord of Light.
Oh, the signature novel by Roger Zelazny.
Exactly.
Wow.
I just loved, that book did things to me on so many levels and hit me so deep.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just, all I could think was, how cool would it be to make other people feel like that?
I want to take a diversion here a second because I was talking to my wife.
Oh, no, you can't do that. You can't divert.
Yeah, subroutine. We're going to go into a subroutine.
My wife and I
were talking the other night. We were watching Lost in Space, the original series on Netflix, the remake. And we were thinking about how people get inspired to go into science because she's a professor.
Right.
And so a lot of her students don't really know where they want to go. They're not really highly motivated. They're not showing evidence of being highly inspired like you were by Lord of Light and how I was by Robert Heinlein. And they're not driven. And the question in my mind is, why isn't science fiction more inspiring these days? Why does it have to be so much of a downer and negative and destructive? What's gone wrong with science fiction? And why can't television and movies and sci-fi inspire people to say, wow, I want to be an astronaut. I want to be a physicist. I want to be an astronomer. I want to be like that person.
Because these things don't come out of nowhere. So any literature is a product of existing conditions. I mean, when we're writing about the future or the past, we're writing about now. And these are people, these are writers processing their understanding of where we're at or maybe how to get out of where we're at or how we got into where we're at. And a lot of them are very confused, but that's okay. I mean, out of confusion comes some great work.
So when Clark was writing, he was writing about geosynchronous satellites, and we were on our way to the moon, and the future looked unlimited in terms of space travel.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. That's where Star Trek was born.
Yep. Funny, Lost in Space. We're going on to another diversion now.
Well, we turn from subroutine. Sorry. Next subroutine.
Yeah.
Proceed, sir.
Oh, actually, no, I think we're nested. This is from Lost in Space. I was at a convention years and years ago called the Atlanta Fantasy Fair. And I think they later became Dragon Con, unless I've got that backwards. No, I think it's right. It was Atlanta Fantasy Fair. And it was a huge science fiction convention, mostly media. And I was like the guest writer, and a writer in a situation like that, you know, you sort of wander around aimlessly and people look at you funny and go, what are you doing here? But one of the actual, you know, people who was important was Jonathan, I lost his name. The guy who played Dr. Smith on Lost in Space.
Right. I forgot his last name, too.
But anyway, so he was up there telling stories about Hollywood, which is sort of, you know, what you do when you're at these gigs. And I'm sitting there, and my brain is broken. I'm going, Dr. Smith just used the F word. And my little 8-year-old brain was going, this can't be.
I'm glad you said the F word, because this show is G-rated. Well, I want to go back to your first book. So to be successful in your first try is pretty amazing and gives you a lot of confidence. I have read stories from authors who say sometimes your first science fiction novel is a catharsis. It's your idea of what you want to do, but it's nobody else's. And when your first catharsis, your first magical vision comes out and people jump all over it, that's a magical occurrence, and that leads to even more success. Is that how it kind of went?
That is exactly how it kind of went, and I can tell you why it went that way.
I want to hear why.
His name is Steve Hickman, and he gave me the most spectacular cover a first novel has ever had.
Normally, an author doesn't have much control over that.
I don't. I didn't have any. I was luck of the draw, and I keep saying my career has been built on luck, and that's a huge part of it. What a gorgeous cover, and all of the ones. And then I've pretty much not gotten a bad cover my entire career. Other writers hate me.
Yeah, I was talking to Strauss. What's his first name? The British.
Charlie, yeah.
Charlie Strauss. I was talking to him about.
Good writer.
Yeah, and his Merchant Princess series. And we were exchanging some email about it. And he said, yeah, that's not how my vision of her looks at all. And I didn't really care for the artist's covers. And it just, you know, I didn't have any control and I was pissed. Charlie Strauss was great. I tried to get him on the show, but he was just so busy.
You understand that the Jereg that Steve painted on that picture looks nothing like the Jereg as I envision it. And the cover, there's one where he's got a picture of Vlad, my protagonist, and he looks nothing like my vision, and I don't care. The job of a cover is, well, for one thing, to be striking and gorgeous, but it's kind of a selection thing. The ideal cover is going to appeal to the sort of person who will like the book.
Mm-hmm. It sparks their imagination.
Yeah, and what you want to do, what you want to avoid, are readers who feel like, well, the cover lied to me. This isn't at all the kind of book I thought it was. And I haven't gotten that.
Yeah, that is very fortunate. Very fortunate indeed.
Is it okay if I stretch for a second?
Yeah, it's a good time for us to take a break. Folks, so we need to take a commercial break here for about 60 seconds. I'm chatting with science fiction writer Stephen Brust. We will be right back. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you. I'm chatting with science fiction writer Stephen Brust. So I'm going to give you an opportunity.
My name right.
I'm sorry?
Thanks for pronouncing my name right. That's rare. Did you practice? Did you research it?
Well, I normally before the show check on the authors or on the guests' pronunciation, but today I forgot to do it. So
I don't remember you asking.
I'm just winging it. I forgot.
So good job there.
Yeah, it's probably because I speak a little German and suspected how it was pronounced.
Uh-huh,
so I'm going to give you a few minutes here to talk about your first novel. The overall review, the outline of the story, the characters, you know, what's going on with your first book and the successors in the series. So for the listeners who are not familiar with your work, so give us a thumbnail sketch.
All right. It's a first-person protagonist, kind of callback to the noir sort of feel. It's a fantasy world. Think The Sopranos meets Lord of the Rings.
Okay, there's an assassin involved, right?
Right, he's a hit. The guy's a hitman for a sort of sword and sorcery mafia.
Ah, shades of Roger Zelazny are creeping in
well,
here.
Yeah, and also, you were talking about the old masters. Did you also read Fritz Leiber?
Yeah, from time to time, but he wasn't one of my hot list authors.
He was, because that was, the world is heavily influenced by his Fofford and Gray Mauser book stories. And of course, the tropes I'm using, the fantasy tropes I am playing with, were pretty much all invented by Michael Moorcock.
Oh, I remember him too. That name rings a bell.
Yeah.
So like George Lucas, your stories are synthesis of great stuff in the past that gets cooked and reemerges with new elements and new imagination.
Yeah, with all that, without the new elements and new imagination, there's not a trace of originality in there. but yes, I love Zelazny, as you know, and that sort of feel and tone. Think of it as a lighthearted kick in the balls.
You know, one of my favorite writers is Robert Parker, the mystery writer. He's no longer with us.
Oh, he's so wonderful.
And if I ever write, I want to write like Robert Parker because he writes these two-page chapters that are written in the first person. And the characters are awesome. Let's see. There's the Sonny Randall series, and then there's the guy played by Tom Selleck. His name is
Spencer.
No, the other guy.
Yes, Spencer.
Yeah, Spencer, but there's also another series.
Oh, that Tom Selleck played Spencer. Oh, wait, no, I see. You're right.
Yeah.
I remember that now. I don't remember the name of it.
But he writes in the first person, and he writes these short paragraphs, short chapters. And when you get to the end of the chapter, it's like, I got to go on. It's a page turner. And yep. when I went into science fiction novels with these 70-page chapters of dense type, I can't take it.
Well, you know, I am a child of... I grew up in the 60s, and my aesthetic was defined by the Wild Wild West and The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Oh, same here.
So what that means is... I think, and I'm not proud of this. I just want to say in advance, this is not a good thing, but it's simply the case and I can't shake it. I think in terms of 13 and a half minute sections followed by a commercial.
That's okay.
And that's just sort of how my brain puts a scene together. And so my chapters have that feel in a way of you know, here we're going to, oh, you know, the thing in a chapter where you end a chapter with a punch. Parker does that really well. So did Zelazny.
Yeah. Oh,
would
yeah.
you like to know who invented that?
Yes.
I'm not going to tell. No, I'm sorry. Alexandre Dumas.
I've heard the name. I think I ran across him in my high school English classes, but boy, it's been forever.
The Three Musketeers?
Oh, okay. Okay.
Guy who wrote that in The Man in the Iron Mask and The Count of Monte Cristo?
Oh, yeah. Classic English classes that you want to forget.
Well, the point about an English a classic English class is that it's trying to teach you to hate classics. and for the most part, it does a really good job. It took me 10 or 15 years after that to slowly realize that the reason these books are classic is because over the course of time, a whole lot of people have thought they were really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of Twain defined classic as a book that people praise and don't read.
I want to move along here because we have a lot to cover and not much time to do it in. So you told me before the show that we're talking to you on a PC. Heaven forgive you. How did you avoid falling into the Mac sphere, sir?
do you really want to get into my criticisms of Macintosh?
Yes, please.
Seriously?
Yes.
Okay. I grew up in the DEC world, and we in the DEC world hated IBM with a deep and powerful passion.
Oh, sure. IBM was always trying to mess with Digital Equipment Corporation.
And,
oh, yeah.
Well, and with everyone else, because what they would do is they would come up with something more or less decent, product, hardware usually, that was good, that was useful, and they would make it proprietary. They would make it unable to work on anyone else's machine, so you had to buy their product. And everyone else in the computer industry in that period was standardizing.
Yeah.
Well, then we enter the, you know, so you could.
I see where this is going.
Yeah. And so I developed a deep hatred of Apple for exactly that reason.
I understand. I come from a Unix background myself. Worked at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory.
Love Unix.
Yeah. So I was up to my ears in Unix for years in Oak Ridge and loved it.
Yeah. Hey, I still write my books in Emacs. First draft is in Emacs.
That was my next question. I wanted to ask you what tool you use. Some publishers force their authors to use Microsoft Word.
Do they really?
Oh, my goodness. Or at least submit in Word format.
I had no idea.
If you're using a tool like Scrivener or something like that, you can export in Word
format. I am now transitioning to Scrivener.
Oh, great, great, because that's an awesome program.
Yeah, what's happening is that I have a writer crush, if you will. I am in writer love with a Texas writer named Skylar White. We've written three books together, and it is so much fun. And there is no way I am going to try to produce fiction in Google Docs. Thank you very much.
Nor should you.
You know, I'll use Post-it notes first.
And yeah.
But in trying, she does use a Mac and is very happy with it, by the way. So trying to solve the problem of how we work our collaborations, especially because we do a lot of, you know, a lot of very brief swapping back and forth. Here's a scene, mm-hmm. bam, mm-hmm. here's a scene. And I think she started using Scrivener. And from what she said, I realized that would be a really good and easy way to allow us to port our versions back and forth. And it turned out to be the learning curve, as you know, is horrible. I mean, it's you really got to devote some time to learning how to work that thing. I think I've gotten like 10% of it. I now can use.
But it's a really powerful tool. It has so much potential.
Yeah, that 10% is great. I wouldn't trade it for anything. It's eventually there's a way to do everything I want.
Including export as DocX.
Right. And yeah, I usually end up with RTF as my final.
Tor will accept that?
Yeah, they're pretty easy.
Good for them.
Well, one time I sent my editor, this was purely by accident in the earlier days of word processing, a completely bollocksed thing with some complex format that she couldn't speak. And my editor, Teresa Nielsen Hayden, spent hours laboriously decoding it to get the book out.
Editors are usually heroes.
Yeah, she is, but she did it. So a couple of books ago, I think, which one? Hawk. When I turned in Hawk, I believe what I did is I ran it through a word sorting program. So what I sent her was all the words in alphabetical order. A little note saying, put these in order. You know the drill. I think I thought it was funny. She did.
That sounds like a fun trick. Tell me about the financial side, if you can, of the business. I've talked to some writers who, by and by, have found that the paper book publishing business, hardbacks and softbacks, and the difficulties Barnes & Noble's having, Borders is already gone, has made it tough for them in the physical bookstore realm, and they've turned to Amazon, where before they were getting, you know, $20 for a book, now they're getting $2.99 for their novels. Do you have any comments you'd like to make about how you're moving through this process?
There's a lot of this that I don't know about, that I deliberately keep my distance from, because it will just upset me and won't help me write better. I want to live in a world where I can shove manuscripts underneath a door and checks will come back and I don't have to think about it.
So your books are selling well with Tor. Tor's putting them out on the bookshelf. Royalty checks are coming in and you're happy.
We're back to the theme of luck. There's a thing that happened that killed hundreds or possibly thousands of writer careers. And it happened, I don't want to get the year wrong. What happened was the whole book paperback, mass market paperback distribution system, three big distribution companies pretty much bought up and destroyed all of the tiny little ones. The result of this was to kill the middleist author. You know, the very best, the top 2 or 3% of paperback sellers were still doing great. If you go into a grocery store now and look what's on the racks, those are people doing great. But it used to be there were a lot wider variety in those grocery stores, and each individual grocery store guy would go to his distributor and say, okay, here's what people in my area like. Get me this and this and this. And that doesn't happen anymore. They tell you, here's what you're going to have. Okay, all of which is to say, as that was happening and destroying careers at that moment, my hardcover sales took off.
Pretty nice.
I just got, again, really lucky. And I seem to have developed a loyal fan base who keeps buying my hardcovers. And that's both a joy and a burden, because if I let that get into my head, it will hurt my writing.
What would you say to young people who want to be science fiction writers today?
I would say two things. One, if you're good enough to make a career writing, you're smart enough to make a better career doing something else. But the real advice is write the book you wish someone else had written because you want to read it. That's what I've been doing from my very first novel.
That's always great advice. Hopefully, that vision meshes with what the publisher thinks is selling and what the readers want these days.
Yeah, and again, once more, we come back to luck.
Yeah.
Because if it had turned out that the things I think are cool, I'm going to... Pardon me. I'm going to put this in because that's really cool. I'm going to have this happen. I love when that stuff happens. I'm going to do this. If it had turned out that no other reader thought that was cool or very few others, I'd be out of luck. I'd still be a mediocre programmer or working at Burger King or something.
Yeah, it's best to try to do it as a night job and see if you can make it and still hold down your day job.
Well, that's what I did up until I reached an impossible point. I think it was I was working on Broke Down Palace, and it was 1986, I guess, if memory serves. And the desire to write was just getting more and more overwhelming. And so I would go into work and I couldn't concentrate because I wanted to be writing. And that made me so frustrated that when I got home, I couldn't write. That's the point where you say, okay, I guess I'm going to take the leap right now because what else can I do?
Yeah, it becomes a passion.
Yeah.
I have a couple of theories about writers, too.
I'd love to hear them.
Well, for some reason, I have noted that all of my technical colleagues in the Mac community and writers and people I've interviewed and had on the show, especially people who write either fiction or nonfiction, tend to be cat people. And I was looking at your bio, and there's a thread of cat life in your bio, and I wanted to ask you if you are a cat person and what you think of my theory that people who are writers are naturally more drawn to cats, especially because they're sort of like quiet, pleasant alien beings who are, you know, nearby and affectionate but don't demand a lot from the writer and can be there and not be barking. And because they're so cool and calm and they sort of fit with the writer's psyche. That's been my theory. I want to run it by you and want to see what you think.
Well, okay. First of all, I have a cat. I love my cat.
Bingo. I knew it.
But I am more of a dog person.
Oh.
Because what you get from your dog is what you will never get from your fans. Unconditional love.
Yeah, the cat kind of says, I don't know about this guy.
but I will. That said, you're right. There's an astonishing number of high percentage of writers who have cats.
Yes,
it's it's true. So I don't know. I also have a bird. He's a rat.
Rich Siegel was on the show. He's the founder of Barebone Software, the author of the famous BB Edit software, and he had a parrot, I think, that was in the background during the show. It made for an interesting show.
That's what I had. I had to move him out because I was talking to someone else and therefore ignoring him. Therefore, he must scream to show his displeasure.
I have no parrot, but I must scream. Well, I wanted to get in a little bit into your music life, but unfortunately, we're out of time. So maybe we'll have to defer that to some other time.
Sure.
So I guess we're going to have to kind of bring it to a close.
Well, this has been delightful.
It has been delightful. Do you want to tell us about anything you're working on now that you can tell us about to kind of whet the listeners' appetites?
Let's see. There is a collaboration I just finished with Skylar, which has not yet sold. We're hoping to find somebody who wants to publish it. But just for fun, we took a section of the book, which is called The Sword of Happenstance, and turned it into a short story, which also has not sold. And then we took a section, and then we took the short story and turned it into a performance piece. So there is a link to that on my website, in fact, if you can make your way through the politics. I think it's the right now the second item down on the front page. I've been neglecting my blog terribly.
I'll link to that about page in the show notes. And yeah, I'll also link to the Dragon feedback page.
Yeah, we did a reading. A friend of ours taped it and videotaped it as we were reading, and it was really fun. But it was, intended as a performance piece based on the book.
Cool. Well, we'll look for that, and I'll put it in the show notes. All right, so let's wrap things up here. Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
I'm on Twitter as at Stephen Brust. I've got my personal blog.
Right. I'll link to that in the show notes too. Okay. Well, thanks for being on the show. This has been a lot of fun. I think I've had more fun in the last 30 minutes than I've had in a long time. Thank you for joining me.
Well, I've had fun too. So there, it's a win. At least two of us did.
Great. Listeners, thanks for coming by. I hope you enjoyed the show. You've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you again next week.